From the Sky News Centre at 6, the wife of a British man jailed for life in the United Arab Emirates says she won't rest until her husband is home. The family of Matthew Hedges are asking for his release after he was sentenced to life in prison in Abu Dhabi for spying. The UAE's ambassador in London says the plea for clemency is being considered. Daniela Tejada says she's trying to be positive.
I hope that they will see it in their hearts that this is a good man with incredible good nature. That deserves to be free. But I am disappointed at the fact that the UAE insists that there has been due process.
There's been a sharp increase in the number of migrants making the dangerous crossing by boat from France to the UK. Another 8 people have been rescued from a dinghy off the Kent coast today. It brings the total this month to around 90. French officials say the situation's getting worse. Former Coast Guard Andy Roberts says the English Channel's hard to navigate.
They're in boats that are 3-4 metres long with 7, 8, 9 people on board each boat. They haven't got the training, they haven't got the equipment, and a tragedy will occur, I'm certain.
The energy firm Spark, which has 290,000 customers, has gone bust. It's the 7th small supplier to collapse this year. A convicted paedophile has denied killing 2 9-year-old girls in 1986, saying he was bullied into making a false account by Sussex police. 52-year-old Russell Bishop, who's on trial for the second time, has also admitted feeling deeply ashamed for abducting another girl in 1990. UKIP's leader has defended his decision to appoint far-right activists Tommy Robinson as an advisor. Gerald Batten says he thinks it'll help turn the party into a mass movement and denies offering a welcome to racists. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Well, helping me review this week's news, Lib Dem councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, one of the victims of the Manchester Arena terror attack calls for MI5 to come out from under their stone and be prosecuted for the negligence over the bombings. A litany of failures which again and again allow bombers to carry on unhindered. Or is MI5's work impossible, like looking for a needle in a haystack? Also, the cyber war against you being waged using your taxpayers' money. A former GCHQ officer explains methods by which the deep state operating in the shadows has taken away any oversight whatsoever of all the intelligence services, even away from the Queen. Also, following on from last week, over Hope, high-profile political targets who've died in mysterious car crashes, we get to the latest on the taking offline an attempt to prosecute one of the world's most courageous publishers and investigative journalists who published information about the CIA using hacking to kill people in cars. That's Julian Assange, of course. Plus, the US refuses to vote for a UN motion condemning neo-Nazis. Why would they do that? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius, some light rain. This weekend, highs around 9, light rain tomorrow, Saturday, but cloudy on Sunday. Well, cloudy on Saturday too, I should imagine, tomorrow. Next week, there's highs around 11, it's just warming up a little bit from the weekend, patchy rain and breezy at times. Next weekend, that's the 1st and 2nd of December, highs around 9 Celsius, some sunny spells and a few showers. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor Noel Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi.
Again. The whole saga of Anna Klonowski, she used to be our chief executive. She was here for a few months and then she disappeared. What's the latest on what's the repercussions been about what happened with her? Because mainly her job seemed to be to arrive with the new mayor, Marvin Rees, to make some big rearrangements to the way that the council offices were run, and many of them having to leave as a result, and bringing some new ones in. Is that a fair representation?
Well, certainly she left just after the media started making inquiries about all the complaints they'd had from senior officers, because a lot of them were leaving.
Well, a lot of senior officers are bound to complain. If they're being told you're no good, they're going to complain, aren't they?
Well, it was not a good management method. It's been shown that it was a disastrous failure for the city, her time in charge. And basically...
Well, okay, hang on, because surely the proof is in the pudding. We're here now. I mean, how can you say it's been a failure, what she did?
It's been fairly for the city. It might have delivered what Mr. Rees actually wanted, was to get rid of all the officers, but that's hardly a success.
Well, hang on, he didn't get rid of all of them, did he?
Well, the vast majority of senior management have actually gone, yes, and they've been replaced by people who have no knowledge of Bristol or how the institution actually works.
One of the things I always like to do on this show is to give the right of reply to Marvin Rees, but of course the mayor has decided he's too busy to come on this programme. I know you've also said that there seems to be a culture of secrecy around the council business these days. What evidence have you got for that, Gary?
Well, just reading emails just 5 and 4 came in here about councillors from different parties complaining, we didn't realise this was happening, or that exactly happened, or the consultation that's closed. We didn't know it had actually opened. After a lot of criticism from opposition parties and actually from the LGA visitors that were spun as being given a good bill of health to the administration, they actually complained that the administration was keeping its plans secret so that they couldn't be scrutinised. And we all agree on that. Now, we'll see if it's actually going to change, but that's a bad way to run an administration.
Well, it's Anna Klonowski got $98,000, I believe.
That's correct, yes. And basically...
Is that extra on top of her salary?
It was.
That's £100,000 of our council tax money. What did she actually get it for? Because as I understand, she left voluntarily.
Well, that's what Marvin said. But that's obviously not true, because she left just a couple of days after media inquiries coming in, and she became too hot to handle. It was also the case that opposition parties were starting to ask lots of very awkward questions, and that's why she had to go.
What was this $100,000 for, then? I mean, we'd love to ask Marvin, but as I said, he won't come and answer questions.
It was hush money.
Why was he to be quiet about what?
About what was going on and what had actually happened during her administration. It was a catalogue of disasters. But of course, you know, Marvin couldn't have it coming out because it was him that had actually dragged her in the first place after a lot of advice to the contrary. So he was personally identified with her. So anything that went wrong that came out was down to him personally.
So this, what you're alleging here is that this money was paid to her, £100,000, in order for her to sign some sort of gagging clause, or was there anything actually signed?
Yes.
What?
Well, I haven't seen it, but the auditors who've criticised the administration for misdescribing the payment, which is effectively, you know, akin to false accounting.
So what did they describe it as, and what do you think it should have been described as?
They said it was part of her salary. That she was entitled to, and the auditors said, no, it isn't. And several of us from different parties have been campaigning on this for a very long time. Now, the auditors have finally agreed with us on this, refused to sign off the accounts until the description was changed, and the audit committee now of the council is actually digging into this to try and get at some of the documents.
So the official auditors are also... I mean, have they signed the accounts off yet? If the thing is, a good auditor, if there's little questions like this that haven't been resolved, won't sign the accounts off until it is.
Well, they refused to sign them off until the description, until it was properly described as to what the payment was for. In other words, it was a payment that was made that didn't have to be made.
Martin Summers, what do you make of this? This does sound like a bung, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, the information I get about this is from coming on this show and hearing what people have to say about it, so I haven't really got much comment to make.
Is that because he's a Labour mayor?
I listen to what people have to say.
A Labour mayor, so you're listening but you don't have any opinion?
Well, no, I do. If it is, as people say, then that's probably out of... I don't agree with elected mayors anyway, as Gary well knows.
But we're not talking about whether there's too much
power in the mayor's office, which then leads to these kind of problems emerging.
Is it easier, do you think, to keep things stum, keep things quiet? Actually, stum is generally a good term, so maybe I shouldn't use that one, but to keep them quiet when under the new mayoral system?
Absolutely. It's a recipe for disaster, and that's what we've had over the last few years, and I'm very glad to say Bristolians will have the chance in a few years to vote to get rid of the system, and I sincerely hope they take it, and all the indications are so far that they will.
So the Lib Dems have been instrumental in that, and I think it was Barbara Jank, wasn't it, that actually got that passed?
She managed to slip in an amendment into the Localism Act to give Bristolians the chance to do a reverse referendum, and actually then we had to go and persuade, in fact I had to go and persuade Greg Clark, who was the Communities Minister at the time, not to reverse it in the Commons. So basically it's there, it's on the statute book, we will have the right.
Well, I understand that other cities have already always had the right. It was Bristol. Bristol was the one odd one out there. I think the problem of having an elected mayor and 70 councillors with a party structure is the two things don't pull in the same direction. It's a bit like gridlock in the US system, where the president and the Congress and the Senate don't agree about stuff, then nothing can get done.
I don't know how you manage it, Martin, but gridlock is exactly what we're going to talk about now, which is the buses. We've got a protest on College Green tomorrow. Starting mid-morning anyway, Gary. I know you've actually been quite a big campaigner on buses, haven't you?
Absolutely, and I will be there tomorrow.
What's gone wrong?
Well, basically, you go back about 30 years to the bus privatisation, but the problem locally here is that eventually the previous government actually agreed to a buses bill where power can be given to local metro mayors to actually franchise buses as they do in London, which is what we actually need. But neither the Bristol mayor nor the metro mayor, Tim Bowles, are interested in franchising. They can't understand it. They don't know why it's necessary. And unless they take those powers, we're going to be at the behest of a private monopoly, which is a disgrace.
Now, the actual on the ground there, it's been a situation where there's been quite a lot of problems with the app people use to. I mean, we keep hearing about how amazing it is, all this smart ticketing and all this kind of thing and buzzwords like that. But actually, it's no good when the app doesn't even open, or you can't buy a ticket on the app, or the phone runs out of power just as you're about to get on the bus. But it's also, isn't it, a lack of drivers?
Well, I mean, lack of drivers, lack of organisation, but the problem comes back to a private monopoly that completely dominate things, squeeze up the fence. I just could not believe the stupidity of the mayor the other week when first put through a 33% increase in their fares, and he actually welcomed it as a move towards equality. I mean, you know, it's just absolutely staggering.
Well, why? Hang on, because there was the idea is to have a flat fare, isn't it? So that people who are doing short journeys pay the same as people doing long journeys.
Yeah.
That actually benefits a lot of people on the outskirts of the city.
None at all.
No?
No, because people on the outskirts of the city didn't buy two £2.50 tickets as they tried to maintain to go into town and out of town. They bought a £4 day ticket. And they still buy a £4 day ticket, but unfortunately, that's gone up as well, unless you buy it in advance online.
Okay, so the flat fare is only for the short journeys, and First Bus know that that's going to be almost all those journeys we're going to be done in the central area, which are going to be the short, the less expensive tickets, so actually this is really a fare increase.
Good.
And actually, applauded by the mayor,
exactly.
As if it's something good.
Exactly, 33% increase. Fares went from £1.50 to £2. And it's not just right in the centre. My own ward, Knoll, has some very severe areas of deprivation. Great area, but it has some very severely disadvantaged people. and they're having to pay a 33% increase in bus fares.
Do you think that Marvin gets bungs from First Bus? It sounds like he's doing their PR for them. Basically, spinning to try and make it sound as if what they're doing is good.
Well, unfortunately, I can't understand what his motivation is, but basically it's a staggering disgrace. And when I asked him questions about this last time in council, there was this sort of slow dawning on his face that he was suddenly realising that he'd been supporting a big fare increase.
Was that before or after he did his marvellous speech about it all?
Well, which one was this?
Well, this is the State of the City speech where he was talking
about it. Oh,
it was
after that, yeah. So after.
Anyway, look, one of those things that it's interesting that there's a bit of unanimity around the City Council, not with the Mayor, but with other people in the Labour group, and one of them is Mark Bradshaw. He used to be the transport portfolio, I think, going back to the days of Mayor Ferguson as well, and before that
in the Labour administration.
Yeah, so yeah. Mark has seen through a lot of the things like the Metro bus, which hasn't made a lot of difference, but I mean, it's a thankless task.
Actually, it has made
a difference. You think so? Go on, tell us that.
Well, the First Bus had to admit they've got twice as many passengers as they projected for on the first route coming in from North Bristol. It should have been a roaring success. The previous mayor messed it up. He overspent, redirected a route, caused years of delays. If he hadn't been meddling away 3 years ago, it would have been functioning and producing really good results.
It seems like transport in Bristol is a bit like Brexit. The people don't really seem to stay there for very long. They get sort of elbowed out by the mayor.
Well, I mean, it's not just transport.
Or they resign. They resign. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. Sorry.
It isn't just transport, is it? I mean, you know, it's been a merry-go-round. You look at his original cabinet, and how many is left? About two or something out of that lot.
Any thoughts on why Vari Threlfall has resigned?
I think there's quite a large section of the Labour Party who want to distance themselves as much as possible from the mayor.
Well, let's have a listen now to, I suppose, he's not quite voiceless, Mark Bradshaw, but he's someone I think who would be one of the people who would be at least being listened to by the bus protesters, and because he's got at least a few thoughts about why we're in this situation and what the situation, or what we should be doing, to sort it out.
In 1985, the Conservatives took away all the controls over local bus services outside London. So it's essentially a commercial free-for-all. So if you've got an operator's licence and the consent of the traffic commissioner, who's a civil servant, you can run a bus service. I could buy buses or lease buses, and as long as my drivers were properly accredited and my service was properly accredited, I could run a bus service between Bedminster and Temple Meads or Bedminster and Parkway, and it's a free-for-all. And First have a monopoly over the Bristol market. They have had for some time. In other parts of the country, it's other operators. The only way you really tackle that over time is give authorities outside London the same powers that they have in London, where TfL can franchise and does franchise all local buses.
I mean, if Tim Bowles was to get really tough, what could he do?
Well, he could start a franchise process on some of the key routes. So he could actually put out to tender a service specification for, say, services up the Gloucester Road or up Park Street or into South Bristol. And he could specify the type of vehicle, the frequency of the vehicle, the maximum fares, which we've done for Metrobus, actually. We did that for Metrobus because we used different powers to be able to do that. He could do that, put it out into the market and see what the price is. Of course, there is a cost involved with this, but you have control because if they don't perform, you can get rid of them over time. And this has happened in London, where different operators have come and gone because they haven't lived up to service standards. It's interesting, when I was talking to colleagues in TfL, given the whole network that they run across London and into suburban London, TfL doesn't own one bus. It's all provided by a range of private operators, probably 10 of them, all working to a common standard, common delivery, common fares, timetable and route map can be done. There is a cost involved. I think it would send a message to bus operators in Bristol that actually, unless they got their act together, there could be a whole new situation here. Of course, Bristol's a relatively small market, but if you extend it across Greater Bristol, you're talking, well, about 1.1, 1.2 million. You know, it's quite extensive then. And these franchising powers do exist in the city deal, in the legislation that enabled the city deal. And I think all it would take is one to get it started and perhaps achieve some real change over time.
Well, there's some real solutions there being talked about by Mark Bradshaw, who used to be on the Cabinet before Vary Threlfall, who was recently resigned from the Cabinet, on transport, Gary. Look, I mean, really, what he's saying there is it's Tim Bowles is simply just not pulling his finger out, and, yeah. And we're not hearing. I mean, actually, Marvin himself has taken over the transport portfolio, but we're not hearing this from him.
No, absolutely not. I'm very glad that Mark's finally come round to our point on franchising.
Well, hang on, because you did do a joint letter with him, didn't you?
We did over the last few months, and that was regarding the management structure in the city council, which has downgraded transport. But what I'm saying is, some years ago, Labour Party and Tory Party campaigned against us when we said that franchising was the way forward. It was more difficult to do, to be fair, some years ago, but it's absolutely the answer, and we're very glad that Mark's on board. Possibly that's something to do with Mari's leaving as well, that she realises that's what's got to be done, and it is absolutely necessary. And I hope that our petition that young Max is actually putting about for us to take control, actually it will get to a large enough number and will be debated in council, because we want to pin all those people who say we don't want franchising, including the mayor, and get them to explain themselves.
Yeah, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Also, just to let you know, First West of England, I did invite them on this programme, and someone called Rob Pym, who I'm not quite sure what his job title is, but their press office was said, well, we may, he may be able to come, but then we were told, no, he won't. So they sent me a press statement instead, most of which is actually waffle, including a load of stuff about Metrobus, which isn't really relevant to the protest tomorrow. They say, we understand and sympathise with Ms Langland's frustrations and those of other bus passengers who've been affected by delays in recent weeks. Everyone wants to get to work. Well, we know that, First Bus. This is rather patronising, actually. Our top priority are our customers. We work hard every day to provide a reliable, effective service. There's absolutely no advantage to us in running poor services.
Well, customers are not their priority, and they've said regularly and on a number of occasions, we are not a public service, we are a private profit-making company. And they are. You can't blame them for that. That's what they try to do, maximise the profit. So they see their job as squeezing the maximum amount of money out of the customers rather than increasing the number of people on public transport.
And I'll carry on with their press statement. We're missing out the bit about Metrobus. But indeed, they say, many of the challenges we've been experiencing in recent months are a product of the success of bus services in Bristol and the west of England. We've seen a 10% year-on-year increase. That's actually 46% over the last 4 years, which is the fastest rate of growth anywhere in Britain.
It has been growing from a very low rate. We're still only about half what the other core cities actually have in terms of percentage of people who use buses. But they did improve dramatically, and they started off improving when the Greater Bristol Bus Network were put in, when the new bus lanes, etc. That started the process. And actually, Metrobus will make a significant difference as well. But it was almost killed off by the previous mayor. He made such a hash of it. But you must have a coordinated approach. And I'm glad that Mark's now with us in terms of franchising, because that's the only way you can do it.
And they finish up by saying, we are urgently discussing with Bristol City Council and the West of England Combined Authority, that's the Metro Mayor, who are responsible for investing in infrastructure to support the smooth and efficient running of the public transport system. Priorities for addressing the heightening congestion issues across Bristol and the neighbouring areas. Tackling delays and hold-ups on the road network is the best way of delivering a more reliable and punctual bus service. So they're saying that really there's loads more demands on the infrastructure. So this is, I'm afraid, you're just going to have to shrug your shoulders and cope with it.
Absolutely not. When the Greater Bristol Bus Network was introduced, it resulted in an increase in bus passenger use significant, particularly for commuters, because it was the main routes coming into town. And the next stage after that should have been to have have the franchising for the buses. What's actually happened was first trousered all the profit from those improved position on congestion. They weren't held up so much, they could move the buses quicker, trousered all that profit, but any other route, they said, we're not going to run it unless you give us a subsidy. And that's what we get with the present system, and that's what's got to stop.
Martin, we've had a strange situation, haven't we, with the Metro bus coming in, where the circle around the edge of Bristol has been widened out into the sort of Tory shires, and as a result, we've got a Conservative Metro mayor, even though actually what the main job of Tim Bowles is, where the congestion, of course, is in the city centre, which would have voted Labour. So it almost looks as if this is a deliberate attempt to have somebody who's not really representing people of Bristol deciding what's going to happen with Bristol's buses.
Well, I come back to what I said. I'm not really in favour of elected mayors of Bristol. I'm not in favour of metro mayors either. This is all a dog's breakfast. There ought to be national transport planning. That's what we used to have. National coaches were run by the government nationally, and local authorities like South Yorkshire used to run the buses, and it worked pretty well. And then we decided to throw all that out the window. We've had 30 years of nonsense. And of course, I agree with franchising. That's the best option that we've got, it looks like. But actually, it should all be run by the public sector on a not-for-profit basis.
It's all happening at midday. I'm sure you'll be down there at College Green tomorrow, Gary. And there's also the petition, of course, which means that there'll be some sort of debate about this at the City Council.
We sincerely hope so. We need everybody to be signing that petition and to get their friends to sign that petition, because it needs 3,500 signatures.
Doesn't Marvin want to talk about this at the City Council?
Well,
I mean, he could just surely say, well, we want to debate about this.
No? Well, he could do, but he doesn't want to debate about it, does he? Because he's in an awkward position, having set himself against this and not being able to reach any kind of agreement with the Metro Mayor. In fact, the progress that was made on public transport in Bristol was actually, the planning was some years ago, that actually led to the increases. And we've had nothing progressing over the last few years. No new plans. And they came in before the Metro Mayor. They came in on cooperation between the four local authorities in partnership. They produced the Greater Bristol Bus Network. They got the money from central government to run to build the Metro Bus. It was the Mayor in Bristol who almost killed that and messed it up.
Well, if you can't go on a bus, maybe you can go on a train. The only trouble is, we want more carriages, say passengers, crammed into packed Bristol commuter trains. It's not legal to ram cattle into transport or the levels of crowding that GWR is pushing humans into, one commuter said. That's in the Bristol Post. We've also got another story. People really don't like the hard seats on the posh new train serving the South West Main Line. Now, this is the line from Bristol to London, Gary. And, I mean, I've been on these trains over the last month or so. They've got some wonderful new trains, but they've actually got horrible, uncomfortable hard seats. It's almost like you've got to squeeze yourself in to the seats as they're in line, because they've packed a load more extra seats in and you can hardly move once you've got in there. And also the trains themselves, they seem to be almost like a kind of sports car, where you're sitting at a station one second and the next minute your cup of coffee's flying towards you and the train is shooting off in the other direction. They also brake really sharply as well. So it altogether a bit of a dog's breakfast for the first group, isn't it?
Well, unlike you, I can't afford to travel on those trains to London. Don't particularly want to either.
I think you'll probably find that the coach, okay, it takes an extra hour or so maybe, but you get more space and a more comfortable seat.
Well, the last time I went to London, I did go on the coach, as it happens. because it was massively cheaper and it went to where I wanted to go to.
Martin, the other thing, of course, here is, I mean, this is a story from a couple of months ago. British Rail passengers spend X times more on train fares than their European counterparts. Would you like to guess what X is? So if you're in Europe and you want to go from A to B on a train a certain amount of miles, how much more are we spending in the UK? This is a little quiz for you.
We're just guessing, are we?
Yeah.
About 30%.
It's actually
three times.
Six times more we're spending over here. Martin, what is going on? It's like some sort of racketeers have taken over our transport.
Well, when John Major privatised the railways in the last gasp of that Tory government. It was said that it was going to be the poll tax on wheels. And basically, it was an absolutely stupid idea. An infrastructure like this, nobody in Sweden, for example, or Switzerland would regard this as at all appropriate to be running the private sector for private profit. But in Britain, we believed in turning the infrastructure into private monopolies for private profit, which actually, of course, then directs investment away from small, medium enterprises and into this, you know, rent seeking in the infrastructure. But of course, in the long run, we should have, the stupid stuff we did in that era should have been reversed. It hasn't been reversed, and we've even got to the stage now where we can't reverse it, so we're stuck with it. And that's the you know, second, third rate situation we have in this country, where we've made loads of stupid mistakes, and not only have we made stupid mistakes, we don't even learn from those stupid mistakes. You know, it's just ridiculous.
33 miles it is from Luton to London. Now the trouble is, it's actually quite expensive to do that trip. In Britain, it's £387 a month. If you were living 33 miles outside Paris or Rome, it's going to be £61 a month. Gary, why are we paying so much more here? Isn't it just because we need to go to work and somebody somewhere is saying, right, well, you're going to pay far way over the odds?
Well, partly on the continent, there's a state subsidy to keep the cost down. And in this country, the cost is actually met by the individual passenger rather than by the state. That's why there's a difference.
Okay, so just to remind folks, it's midday tomorrow. College Green is the Bristol bus process. Now, let's get on to Brexit. There's been quite a lot happening in that this week. And let's go to the House of Commons, where Jeremy Corbyn was wondering about the various Brexit secretaries that Theresa May has had.
Jeremy Corbyn! The Prime Minister is apparently heading off to Brussels today, but the new Brexit secretary is another non-travelling Brexit secretary who's apparently not going with her. I wonder if the post is now an entirely ceremonial one. Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister's agreement doesn't specify how much we'd have to pay to extend the transition period. Can she confirm the choice facing the country would either be the backstop or paying whatever the EU asked us to pay to prolong that transition period?
The Right Honourable Gentleman is wrong on that. The choice that would be facing, if it were the case, let's just remind ourselves what we're talking about here. We're talking about the guarantee to the people of Northern Ireland that there will be no hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. And the choice that we face, first of all, that is best ensured by getting the future relationship in place by the end of December 2020. In the event that that was not the case for a temporary period and an interim arrangement was in place, the choice the Right Honourable Gentleman set out is not the choice that would be before us. What we have, yes, there would be the backstop in the protocol, yes, there would be the extension of the implementation period, but what we have also negotiated in the withdrawal agreement is that alternative arrangements could be in place. The key is that they guarantee no hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland.
So, Gary, what do you think is going on with the Irish? Because it's a bit of a problem, isn't it? It's almost like, it seems like suicide. The people, that the DUP, who keep the Conservatives in power, are not going to back this.
Them in office, they don't keep them in power.
Well, true.
It's a very different thing.
Yeah.
That is just one aspect of the staggering dog's breakfast of a mess.
Well, it's easy to say that, but what's going to happen? We want to hear from you what you think is actually going to happen. Is it going to be no deal? Is it going to be Theresa May's EU deal? Or is it going to be just no Brexit?
I think that we're heading further and further towards no Brexit. I'm a humble councillor, I'm not Mystic Meg, and really it is impossible to tell exactly what's going to happen, but there is no majority for Mrs. May's deal. There's certainly no majority for a no-deal Brexit, despite the swivel-eyed loons on the of the Brexiteers demanding that. And actually what was fascinating to hear today was Dominic Raab, a Leaver, who's actually saying that no Brexit would be better than the deal that Mrs May is putting forward.
Well, you talk about swivel-eyed loons that are going, no deal. Now, when you start getting insulting like that, I start to think, well, I was going to say something specific here, because the former Bank of England governor, Mervyn King, said earlier this year that no deal may be the best option.
I don't think he did say that.
He did, yes he did. But I think it was February. I can quote him if you want. But, I mean, Mark Carney hasn't said it, and he's the guy who actually is in charge. But anyway, so what do you make of that idea? That actually the former governor of the Bank of England is saying that no deal is as good as any other country, like, for example, countries like Canada have got?
Well, it would be a disaster, but the present arrangement that's being proposed will be a disaster. The irony of it is that one of the key things that our Brexit campaign has managed to persuade people about to back them was, we want to be making the rules. We don't want to be taking rules from Brussels. And in actual fact, we're moving, if we go to the present deal, from being one of the rule setters, one of the rule makers, to a rule taker. So it is going backwards.
But surely we don't actually make any of the rules, because Angela Merkel's the only person that really makes the rules. I mean, David Cameron tried to make a few changes, didn't he? And say, we want this and we want that. He got absolutely nowhere.
He tried a rather pathetic, give us a few scraps.
He came back with nothing, didn't he?
Yes. We have actually, through the years, made a huge amount of the EU rules and regulations in all sorts of areas. A lot of our people led on this stuff. And the problem is the Brexiteers managed to persuade lots of people that we were being dictated to by foreigners, whereas in actual fact, we were some of the leading players in the team that made the rules.
OK, well, talking about foreigners, let's go to have a listen to the DUP and Nigel Dodds, who's their leader, at Prime Minister's Questions. So they're rather worried that that's what they're becoming.
Nigel Dodds.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the December joint report agreed between the European Union and the United Kingdom, it was agreed that Northern Ireland would have the final say on whether or not it diverged from the UK single market and was subjected to single market European rules with no say. Why has the Prime Minister deleted all reference to that in the withdrawal agreement? Did she push the delete button?
Can I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, of course he's absolutely right about the December joint report. The issue of what the processes would be within the United Kingdom to look at this issue of regulations is a matter that will be a matter for this United Kingdom to determine both our parliamentary rules, our parliamentary decisions on that, and indeed the Stormont Lock that was expressed in the December joint report. Of course, as the Right Honourable Gentleman will always also know, the lock that was in the December joint report referred to a decision being taken by the Northern Ireland Executive and Northern Ireland Assembly, which sadly we do not have in place today.
Boo hoo hoo. Sadly we do not have in place today. Martin, if Stormont was sitting, they'd be going apoplectic about this, wouldn't they?
Well, the DUP only beat Sinn Féin by 1,500 votes at the last election in Northern Ireland, and the six counties of Northern Ireland voted pretty comprehensively to stay inside the EU. So the mandate for these people to be wreckers is actually quite limited. And, of course, Sinn Féin aren't playing ball, and they're going about Angela Merkel. I'll tell you who's really messing up the Tory government. It's
actually,
Leo Varadkar.
Are you actually...
Asian Prime Minister of Ireland is one who's dictating the rules.
So are you actually a Democrat then? You think that because the Northern Ireland people voted like the Bristol people did to remain, that all the areas, little areas, put a little circle around them all, and they all said that they're going to remain, they can remain, and only the rest
of
the country...
Well, it's a very interesting...
Let me finish the sentence, and only the rest of the country is going to actually do Brexit.
Well, it's a very interesting question, because the six counties of Northern Ireland were carved out of Ireland in 1920. It's not the Irish border, it's the British border in Ireland. And in actual fact, Ulster used to have nine counties.
Are we going to have a reunited Ireland now?
Well, it's come onto the agenda because of all this stuff.
Funny, because Jeremy Corbyn rather does support...
Well, I mean, Arthur Scargill's quite clear. Arthur Scargill, for example...
No, I'm talking about Jeremy Corbyn. He supports the Republicans, doesn't he?
He's got close political relations with the Irish Republican movement going back 30 years. Yes, that's right, Tim.
As you do support.
Indeed. And, of course, Arthur Scargill, of course, is a solid Brexiteer, and he says it's quite simple. And, of course, the problem for the Brexiteers is what he says is just call a United Ireland and then England can leave the European Union. And, of course, the problem for that is we could easily have a no-deal Brexit or a Brexit with a Canada-style deal, but the European Union, with the Irish in the lead, are saying, well, you've got to leave us out of this. Now, the DUP don't represent the majority of opinion in Northern Ireland, and they don't represent the majority of opinion in Ireland, definitely not. So ultimately, of course, the question is, who gets to vote, and where do we draw the lines, and who's a majority and who's not? And of course, there's been lots of people killed about that.
So why do you think that Theresa May left the Irish border question as it is when she relies on the DUP for her majority?
Well, the problem for her is that to keep the Brexiteers happy, she's got to agree to try and leave the single market or the customs union or whatever halfway house that she's trying to cobble up. But to do that, the Irish, working through the EU, and of course that's one of the reasons why the Irish joined the EU in 1973, to give them more clout, are saying you can do whatever you like, but we in Ireland are going to stay within the rules of the single market. Now, we now have a conflict between Irish sovereignty and English sovereignty. Now, who should run Northern Ireland, Tony?
Well,
you think the Irish
minute.
Or the
this
English
is,
should
this
run
is,
it?
This is
or should
this
we
is,
compromise?
This is a UK vote. Isn't it?
Mm. Well, what's the UK, Tony?
That's really what we want, isn't it? But Brexiteers are frightened of giving people the vote now that
people
reality
have had, people have
of Brexit
had,
is actually looming.
Well, it hasn't actually happened, and I don't think people would vote any differently. I don't. It's in.
Oh,
it's
we,
any
we,
reason
well,
all
they wouldn't vote any differently in the six counties
you know
either, Tony.
The opinion polls, Gary, said that we were going to vote Remain, didn't they?
They were
and
right.
They said
on
that Trump didn't have a chance. Hillary
they
was.
They were right.
Yeah, but don't forget, the under 16s didn't vote, and nobody was resident in the European Union got a vote either.
Anyway,
of course, those under 16s did get a vote in the Scottish independence referendum.
So the
question of who votes and all the rest of it, what the mandates are, yeah. we're playing with fire here. This isn't a technical question,
yeah,
is it?
But by overthrowing the referendum, Martin, what we're going to do now is we're going to have a listen back to 1973. Which is when we actually did leave the European Union. We joined the EEC in 1971, and then that was under Ted Heath. And then in 1973, Harold Wilson gave us a referendum to join the EEC, which wasn't the EU. It was a trade deal, and it wasn't a political union. It was actually Margaret Thatcher that got booted out for saying that she didn't want to join. What she said was, I refuse to hand over this sovereign nation to 13 unelected bankers. And then she was out on her ear, and John Major then went and signed the Maastricht Treaty, which was the EU and the political union. But let's go back now to 1973 to have a little listen to some of the debating points that were being made back then, as well as actually our own MP, Tony Benn. Tony Benn, who had all sorts of things to say about it. One person I thought was fascinating is a guy called Peter Shaw. I remember him back in the 1970s, but I hadn't heard him more recently. So we're going to hear now bits from him and also from Tony Benn and Margaret Thatcher as well, and maybe some other voices in there. This is just a short clip from some of the debating points back in when we joined the EEC back in 1973.
And so the message that comes up is fear, because you won't have any food, fear of unemployment, fear that we've somehow been so reduced as a country that we can no longer, as it were, totter about in the world independent as a nation. And a constant attrition of our morale, a constant attempt to tell us that what we have, and what we have is not only our own achievement, but what generations of Englishmen have helped us to achieve, is not worth a damn. What was involved was the transfer of the whole of our democratic system to others.
When I saw how the European Union was developing, it was very obvious that what they had in mind was not democratic.
Tony Benn.
In Britain you vote for a government and therefore the government has to listen to you, and if you don't like it you can change it. But in Europe all the key positions are appointed, not elected. The Commission, for example, all appointed, not one of them elected. And the way that Europe has developed is that the bankers and the multinational corporations have got very powerful positions, and if you come in on their terms, they will tell you what you can and cannot do. And that is unacceptable.
If a European superstate were to be forged, it would almost certainly develop interests and attitudes at variance with those of America. We would thereby move from a stable international order with the United States in the lead to a more dangerous world of new competing power blocks. A democratic Europe of nation states could be a force for liberty, enterprise, and open trade. But if creating a United States of Europe overrides these goals, the new Europe will be one of subsidy and protection.
And I make no complaint of the pro-marketeers, particularly people like Edward Heath and Peter Kirk. They've been beyond criticism in that they have made it perfectly clear that to remain part of a common market is to renounce national status for Britain. They say the nation state is obsolete and we are to recognise it.
It is already a fact that whatever government is in power, our agricultural policy is now controlled from Brussels, our trade policy is controlled from Brussels, our industrial policy is controlled from Brussels.
Yes, the Commission does want to increase its powers. Yes, it is a non-elected body, and I do not want the Commission to increase its powers against this House. So, of course, we are differing. Of course, the President of the Commission, Mr. Delors, said at press conference the other day that he wanted the European Parliament to be the democratic body of the community, he wanted the Commission to be the executive, and he wanted the Council of Ministers to be the Senate. No. 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 Perhaps the Labour Party would give all those things up easily. Perhaps they would agree to a single currency, to total abolition of the pound sterling. Perhaps, being totally incompetent with monetary matters, they'd be only too delighted to hand over the full responsibility, as they did to the IMF, to a central bank. The fact is, they have no competence on money, no competence on the economy, so yes, the Right Honourable Gentleman would be glad to hand it all over.
If you look around the world today, I listen to Gough Whitlam and his 14 million Australians, and he trades heavily with Japan. I'm very fond of the Australians. But do you think he's going to enter into a relationship with Japan where he gives Japan the right to make the laws in Australia? Do you think Canada, 22 million of them, and to the south a great and friendly nation? Yes, they are. But do you think Canada is going to allow its laws to be written by the 200 million people in some union in America? No, no, of course not. The whole thing is an absurdity. And therefore I urge you to reject it. I urge you to say no to this motion, and I urge the whole British country to say no on Thursday in the referendum.
Well, that's from 1973, Peter Shaw. I think he was a Labour MP, Martin, wasn't he?
He was a minister.
Minister. And also we heard Enoch Powell.
Yep.
So quite a few of those were from 73, but there was also a smattering of bits and pieces from more recently. And the first clip, I think, we heard from Tony Benn was much more recent.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you make of what you just heard there? I mean, because we got into something which was an economic union. Now it's very much more than that. We're now talking about a European army, aren't we?
Well, the Maastricht Treaty was signed by the British government at the time. I think it's very interesting that what you have there is a variety of different people from different political perspectives, all opposed to the development of the European Union, whatever you want to call it, but they want completely different things from the independence of Britain. Margaret Thatcher wants no subsidies and free trade, and of course what Peter Shaw and Tony Benn want is nationalisation and the right to tax the rich. Now, in actual fact, the reality is that the British state is actually dominated by an oligarchy, which is dominated by the United States of America, and we haven't had real sovereignty in this country, disappeared at the end of World War II, and it's all basically a lot of hot air. The reality is that the multinationals, the International Monetary Fund, Wall Street, the Pentagon, they are the ones that control Europe and Britain.
So
and they've been controlling us for the last 50 years.
Why do you bother voting then?
I bother voting because you've got to participate in the system unless you're going to be an anarchist. Of course, the Republicans, who you mentioned earlier, famously said we're going to fight with a ballot box and the Armalite. So it's not just voting, is it, Tony?
Let's have a listen now to the Dominic Grieve, Keir Starmer, who's Labour's Brexit spokesperson, being interviewed by the BBC's Nick Robinson about the EU agreement that Theresa May has struck.
For the government to put out sort of headline quotes, but not the detail of what they were actually proposing. I think this is why we need to read it in detail.
Let me put it to you that you've just given us two examples of why, in your view, people would be better off in the EU rather than under this current deal. Overall, is it your view still, as it was during the referendum, that Britain would be better off in the EU?
Well, in the referendum, I was arguing, obviously, that we should stay in the
EU. Do you still
EU.
Think that?
The question...
Forgive me, do you still think we'd be better off in the EU?
The Labour Party voted to have a referendum, and we agreed that...
Do you still think we'd be better off in the EU?
Well, I think, as this document demonstrates, it is nigh on impossible to replicate the benefits that we've got at the current arrangement. But that's
well, quite, but,
not
but Sakira,
the question.
Put it to you, are a pro-European who believes in membership of the EU, led by a lifelong Eurosceptic, planning currently to go into the voting lobbies with Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg and John Redwood with the possibility of a no deal. How is that in the national interest?
But Nick, I don't think listing who's in the lobbies is the question for today. The question for today is, having read the detail, what's the judgment on it? It is inadequate in so many respects. It doesn't meet our tests. It is... The 7 pages on the future relationship is staggering, and I can't believe anybody who's looked at it can be other than surprised at how thin it is. If it's not good enough, why on earth should Labour back it? And if I came on your programme...
Well, you should back it because you've said that no deal would be the worst possible option for this country.
If I came on your programme and said, I've analysed it now, it's pretty lousy, it's inadequate in the following respects, A, B, C, D, E, but we're going to back it, you would be challenging me uphill and down dale that was the wrong approach of the opposition.
That was the BBC's Nick Robinson talking to Labour Party's Brexit spokesman, Shadow Brexit Secretary, I suppose we'd call him, Keir Starmer. Martin, why won't he answer that question that would you rather just stay in the EU?
Well, because the general consensus has been, and I think the Liberal Democrats agree with this, that the referendum result has to be respected, and that therefore we can't just overturn it without another referendum or Parliament. The parliamentary position is clear. If Parliament votes to stay in the EU, Parliament can vote to stay in the EU.
Why are so many of these Labour MPs going to be going through the lobbies with people like Boris and Jacob Rees-Mogg then?
Because it's an opportunity to bring the Tory government down.
Right, so
it's
that's
as simple
more,
as
that's
that.
More important than having a good deal. A decent deal with the EU, is it?
It is, because as I mentioned to you earlier, the real problem is NATO, the Americans and the Pentagon. That's the real threat to our sovereignty, Tony.
That wasn't what was on the ballot paper.
No, what was on the ballot paper was nothing to do with the single market either, was it, Tony? Because both Aaron Banks and Nigel Farage said that we could vote to leave the EU and stay in the single market. That's what people were told. It's a load of rubbish, but that's what they were told.
Actually not true.
They were told... No, they were told that.
Look, just a minute. There was a big discussion about whether to stay in the single market.
Both Aaron Banks and...
Martin, you're just shouting me down. I want to finish my sentence. There was a big debate in the referendum about whether we want to stay in the single market or not. That has not just come up since then. No, it hasn't. Absolute nonsense. I mean, okay. Can we just cut it out there, please? Martin, you're talking to different things.
Mm-hmm. The fact is, now we're in a position where people can see the reality. These are the real choices, not what people said they might be 2 or 3 years ago. Now we have real choices. People need to be given the chance to say, I want this or that or that. And bluntly, playing all those anti-cooperative politicians that you did earlier on, they were using xenophobia from different angles, mm-hmm. but xenophobia, that's what they were using. It's those foreigners over there who are controlling
but
us.
What Peter Shaw was saying was that the idea was fear. You're not going to get any food if you don't vote to join the EEC. That's what Peter Shaw was saying. Anyway, look, let's get on to some real world stuff. And here's from Prime Minister's questions again is, this is to do with schools and crime, this question.
Mike Amesbury.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Over the past 3 weeks, I've surveyed 42 schools in my Weaver Vale constituency. More than £3.4 million will be taken from their budgets, and 60% of these schools have cut staff. The Prime Minister's claim that austerity is over is as credible as her Brexit plan. Yeah. Will the Prime Minister get a grip or step aside?
Yeah. I say
to the Honourable Gentleman. He will know that we are putting extra money into... He'll know we're putting extra money into school funding. He will know that obviously we've changed the national funding formula to make that fairer across the country. And he will also, I would hope, welcome the fact that in the North West we now see over 895,000 children at good or outstanding schools. That's an increase of over 175,000 children since 2010. The Honourable Gentleman focuses on the money going into schools. He also needs to look at the outcomes from schools and the excellent work that is being done by our teachers and the children who are now in good and outstanding schools who weren't in good and outstanding schools under the last Labour government.
And there's another question too about crime and that relating that to schools as well.
Colleen Fletcher.
Last Friday, during Parliament week, I visited St Elizabeth's School in my constituency to meet with the school's council. The children told me that rising crime levels and falling police officer numbers have made them fearful of using and enjoying their local park, the one near their school. Can the Prime Minister tell the school council, and they may be listening today, what strategy the government is deploying to ensure that all young people feel and are safe from crime on our streets and in our public spaces?
Yeah. The Honourable Lady raises an important point. We want young people to be able to feel secure if they're in the, walking in, through the streets or if they're in a park and gathering with their friends. What we need to do in looking at the concern that has been expressed about crime, and particularly I recognise the concern that's been expressed about knife crime and levels of knife crime, is actually tackle this in a number of different ways across the board. It's about ensuring we have the right powers for the police, it's about ensuring that we have the right system in the criminal justice system, but it is also about providing education for young people about the risks of carrying knives. It is also about providing alternatives to those young people who are tempted to join gangs, because a lot of the crime that we see is related to gang activity. So this is something that has to be addressed across the board, but I recognise the importance of doing that to ensure that young people have the security and safety and confidence that they need.
Now, this is, we're talking about really about children having problems with crime, possibly victims of knife crime, but also having cuts to schools, Gary. I mean, this is about austerity, isn't it? Do you regret, the Lib Dems regret going along with the Conservatives on austerity?
No. What we actually did, and actually, if you looked at the reality of the situation, we managed to make reductions in spending that were necessary for several years because there was a financial crisis. They did not have a negative effect for some while. Now, what's actually happened is things have carried on going. We stood in the last election on a basis of putting money back into public services, paying our teachers and policemen more money, etc. That's what we stood on. We lost the election in 2015 on that basis.
Well, you lost it because of Nick Clegg. Everyone looked at Nick Clegg and saw that he cozied up to Cameron and said, we're not voting for these guys anymore.
Well, I mean, people made their choices, didn't they? What they did instead was vote for a Conservative government who have absolutely decimated now public services. Because you can make some savings. You take out some fat from organisations and they still function.
Okay.
You can't do that
very
now.
Very briefly, Martin.
You cannot do that now.
The cuts of the austerity policy was misconceived from the get-go. It should never have been carried out. The attempt to try and reduce the deficit in one term of Parliament was obviously wrong. We're still reducing it three terms later. And, of course, during that period, you lost the country's AAA credit rating,
which shows complete incompetence. Some economists talk about it as self-harming.
It is indeed. I mean, in actual fact, you don't cut public expenditure when you're in a recession. That's what we learned in the 1930s.
OK, time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest Lib Dem Councillor for Noel, Gary Hopkins, buses tomorrow, BCFM noon, College Green, be there. Join us after the news.
And on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.